Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It is Monday morning. And we are less than a week away from the Academy Awards, and so we'll be talking some Oscar topics a little bit later in the show. Coming up right now is the Monday morning movie reviews, and we'll have all the movie reviews. We will also talk box office with Eric, and we'll get Jim and Eric's picks for the major categories, their predictions for the major categories for the Academy Awards, since we won't be on until after the Academy Awards. I'm taking next Monday morning off for the Academy Awards. So, also, my dad's going to tell a joke. He'll call in a little bit later because it's a jokey time. And our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can also check us out. Facebook.com/Nick D Show is the best way to stay connected. All right, let's bring them on. Eric Childress, Colin Suter always join me. Jim Leskowski's been filling in for Colin. Colin will be back in a couple of weeks. And let's get the guys on. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Jim. Hey, Jim.
Hello again, Nick.
All right. Now, before we get started, let's one more time, Jim, tell everybody about the podcast network that you have and how people can hear Eric's podcast, Jim Hankey's podcast, your own podcast as well.
Yeah, it's a nice little mecca, a little community of movie and music-centric podcasts. It's called the Now Playing Network. Right now, we got some new episodes that were just posted, including a great interview with a former blogger and now a band manager, Jim Hankey's Final Emergency, just posted episode 6, and it's quite stellar. And, of course, Movie Madness, hosted by Eric Childress, just posted episode 3, and he's got some reviews and, of course, box office stats and all the things he's known to do very well. And I just posted an episode of my own podcast as well, called Pop Culture Club. That's sort of like a side project from the Directors Club that I also do on occasion, and sort of elaborate on a little bit further on The Witch. It's a little bit more spoiler territory.
Okay.
Talk about the film at length there. So people can check that out at nowplayingnetwork.net.
Nowplayingnetwork.net, nowplayingnetwork.net. And you can also check out Eric's stuff at efilmcritic.com and movies.com. As well. And we're here to talk about the new movies, and we'll also get your predictions for the Academy Awards. But let's get into it. And okay, now here's the weird thing. It's very, very strange to me that none of us saw Race and all of us saw Risen. And if you were to have asked me or told me that that would have been the fact a couple of weeks ago, I would have said, what? But I only had time to see one of the two, and I chose the Kevin Reynolds. I chose the Kevin Reynolds movie. I'm sorry, over the Stephen Hopkins.
Same here.
Yeah. So none of us have seen Race.
No.
I have heard all mixed things about it. I mean, I don't know anyone who really liked it, or I don't know anyone who hated it. What have you guys heard amongst yourselves? Like Eric?
Exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Like nothing really good, nothing really bad, just kind of there.
I've heard a lot of comparisons to 42 in the handling of the story.
Yes,
And it's kind of like what they did with Jackie Robinson's life. They kind of do the same with Jesse Owens with this.
Yep.
So okay, well that's kind of disappointing. Well, I didn't get to see it. I was really surprised by the two directors this week of these films, because I've often liked, well, Kevin Reynolds I happen to love, but I've often liked a lot of Stephen Hopkins movies. What was Hopkins' last movie before Race?
I just looked this up too. Forgot already.
Yeah, I don't even. Yeah, I can look it up.
It wasn't Ghost in the Darkness. It was something he did something after that.
Oh yeah, no, Ghost in the Darkness was like 20 years ago, wasn't it?
I know.
Hold on a second. I'll check it out.
It wasn't very memorable.
No. None of us can. There's three of us, and we can't remember it.
Right. Stephen Hopkins.
Yeah, let's see.
I mean, he's done a lot of TV stuff.
Yeah.
But,
mostly TV. Californication. He's done House of Lives.
The Reaping.
The Reaping.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's why. Why I forgot.
Yeah, that's a terrible movie.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Ugh.
Okay. You know what? After Ghost in the Darkness, he did Lost in Space. I totally forgot he did Lost in Space. Okay. Well, at least he's been busy. He's won some Emmys and stuff. So, all right. We've heard Race isn't very good. But anyway, Well, Jim, why don't you start us out with a movie that I really wanted to see, and I couldn't get to it, and I'm really curious about it. It's called Touched with Fire. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, I was curious about this because I had read a book of the same name, and you know I went to college for psychology, so I'm fascinated with this material. Dr. K. Jameson wrote a book called Touched with Fire, and it's about primarily, it just covers bipolar disorder, but this is not like a straight adaptation. Rather, it's inspired by the material covered in the book. Katie Holmes stars as Carla, who is a published poet who has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and as a result, she's an insomniac and has feverish kind of late night writing sessions. She becomes kind of obsessed with determining who she really is by digging into her past before her diagnosis, much to her mother's concern. Luke Kirby co-stars as Marco, an underground rapper who has also been diagnosed with the same illness. He also has a father here, played by Griffin Dunne, who looks after him, but becomes quite nervous once he realizes that his son has gone off his meds. And Marco doesn't believe he has the illness. And even if he did, he kind of believes that this mania he's experiencing fuels his creativity. And, you know, a lot of artists have gone through that sort of cycle of, you know, well, I'm really, really going through this amazing period of, you know, creativity, and that could be due to my mania, so I don't want to medicate that. And I think that's an interesting idea to cover in a film. And obviously these two characters wind up in the same psychiatric hospital, and then a romance develops. And then it becomes, you know, very conventional and kind of something that, you know, we've seen done many times before. But there is a lot of compassion. There's a lot of honesty brought to the screen by a first-time filmmaker who has gone on record as, you know, saying that he suffered from the illness himself. But this is also a first-time filmmaker's, you know, first attempt at telling a story, and it's not fully developed. He's got really good intentions here, but it just feels underdeveloped. It comes across more like a Lifetime movie in the end. I mean, people who do struggle with bipolar disorder and taking medication to stabilize their condition might get something out of this, and the performances are pretty good. I mean, Katie Holmes is quite restrained and probably does some of her best work in quite a while, but it does turn more into like a heavy-handed lecture. And like I said, sort of falls under the Lifetime movie category by the end. And there's much better films that do a better job of tackling this issue. It's not as terrible as something like It's Kind of a Funny Story. And the only reason to see it maybe is to see some decent acting. But it's a missed opportunity when it comes to bringing something new to the table with this kind of a story. So it's mostly a miss for me.
That's too bad. I was looking forward to it. You know, I think Katie Holmes is a really good actress. You know, I mean, she hasn't done a lot of, you know, a lot of incredible movies. But she'll always, you know, she's proven to me that she's a terrific actress if just for Pieces of April. Alone, and so I always root for her. Now you said it's different than the book. Now it's just inspired by the book, or
yeah. I mean, the book itself was more of like kind of a documentation, almost like an autobiography of the author's experience of, you know, her treating her own bipolar disorder, and I guess that, you know, the filmmaker was inspired. I mean, he read this book. He learned how to get treatment and, you know, felt really inspired to, you know, get help. But in the end, it's really just like a conventional love story, which is bipolar disorder sort of sandwiched in. And it's unfortunate because, you know, like it's almost like last year with Infinitely Polar Bear with Mark Ruffalo. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a movie I want to embrace based on the subject matter, and there's a lot of empathy on display, but it's rather bland and predictable, and kind of the, you know, really intense dramatic scenes come across as very stagey instead of genuine.
Okay, it's a miss. All right, Jim, thanks. Hang on a second, you guys. We got to take a break. We got a couple more movies to talk about. We'll get Jim and Eric's predictions for who will win the Oscars, which is a week from, or I'm sorry, it's this Sunday, coming up on this Sunday. And we'll get all that. Plus, we'll talk box office as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's take a quick break. More Monday morning movie reviews coming up right after we break here and the news on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here. Welcome back to the show. It is Monday morning, and we are doing the Monday morning movie reviews. We're going to give some Oscar predictions as well, just in the major categories, what we think is going to win for Sunday night's Oscars. And we got the box office coming up. My dad will tell a joke a little bit later on. It's a jokey time. Okay, let's get back to the movie reviews. Eric Childress and Jim Laskowski. Jim filling in for Colin Suter. And let's see. All right, Eric, why don't you tell us about Risen?
Okay, well, this is the latest film from Kevin Reynolds, and it takes place right around the around the time of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Joseph Fiennes plays a Roman centurion named Clavius, who is there present at the actual crucifixion, ordered to go there by Pontius Pilate to basically end the suffering once and for all. And he does, and Jesus' body is buried. And then there's some talk about what might be happening with Jesus' body. There is suspicion that there are obviously prophecies in that he is going to be ascended into heaven and resurrected. The Jewish high priests and the Romans obviously have a vested interest in making sure that this belief goes no further than that. So they want to make sure that his body is secured. Well, his body goes missing after a couple days, 3 days precisely.
All right.
Yeah, and Clavius is ordered to investigate what happened to the body. What happened to the soldiers that were put on guard there? It becomes this movie about this investigation. But it's a movie that, because it seems to have already made up its mind, doesn't seem that interested in the actual investigative process. The first hour of this movie, give or take, lends itself to basically Clavius and his trusty sidekick Lucius, played by Tom Felton, going around interviewing people who were there at the interviewing the guards, interviewing some of the disciples, interviewing just anyone who might have witnessed what might have happened the morning that the body went missing. Like I said, the movie is sort of But the opening scene is sort of the whole movie plays as a flashback. So seeing Clavius wander around the desert and with the sort of a dazed look on his face, we sort of get the impression of where this story is headed. Non-believer basically turned into a believer. And the second half of the movie that actually deals with what some of the stuff we've come to know in Scripture is a little bit more interesting, just because it actually is dealing with the material that has been sort of ingrained, if you are a Catholic, sort of ingrained into our heads and whatnot. It's sort of interesting to see some of these scenes play out. But, again, it's playing kind of fast and loose with the actual story, Clavius being there at the time when Jesus shows up and showing his wounds to the disciples. This is not a spoiler alert, anyone, by the way. And you have Cliff Curtis playing Jesus in the film, which in one way is kind of inspired casting, but on the other hand, the way Jesus is sort of portrayed in the movie is just kind of, like happy hippie Jesus walking around. I don't think the movie really has its heart really invested in everything. With the Passion of the Christ, by the end of that movie, even after all the suffering, you really got a sense of what that film the story of Jesus is all about. With this one, it's, just a non-believer turning into a believer. They don't really take the route that Ridley Scott tried to do with Exodus, Gods and Kings, where they tried to pin science as opposed to the hand of God. And it just kind of sits there. It winds up pretty boring for the first half, a bit more interesting in the second half where the film's heart really seems to lie. But ultimately it's just a way too mixed a bag to really care about this film.
Okay. All right. Jim?
Yeah, I'm pretty much right in agreement there. I found the first half to be a little tedious with all interviewing that was taking place. I mean, I wanted something, I don't know, more dramatic, more intense to occur, or just something to change it up with, you know, just all these interviews taking place. I kind of wanted Fred Willard to show up at one point just going, "What happened?" or something different, because it really got old after a while. And then, yeah, the second half, you know, it piqued my interest a little bit, but, Clavius just, he transitioned so quickly from cynical skeptic to a true believer that I almost didn't buy it. And I mean, the film consists of scene to scene kind of experiences that are very humane. But I just, like, the emotion wasn't there entirely for me. It just never hit me in any profound level. Whereas, like, obviously The Last Temptation of Christ, you get a sense of where all this faith and conviction and belief are really put to the test. But here it's just, it's pretty middle of the road and not as strong as Kevin Reynolds' more challenging and interesting work in the past. I was kind of just blah, you know, it was just fine. I didn't really feel one way or the other when I walked out of the theater.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm with you guys. I may have liked it a little bit more than you guys do simply because it's a very well-made movie. And some of the themes in the film are consistent with what Reynolds has done in the past and things that he's explored in the past. This, to me, seems like Kevin Reynolds, he did a polish on the script. It was the original script, the script that was given, because I read a little bit about this. The script that was, he came in as like a hired gun on this. He gets, you know, but Paul Aiello is the guy who wrote the original screenplay and the original story, and then Kevin Reynolds did a polish and changed it. And it is a pretty bland film, but there are things in it that I really like. I think some of the performances are good. I think Joseph Fiennes is quite good in this movie, and I think Cliff Curtis is actually really good. And Eric, I really think the casting is great, and you know, and a really interesting choice, as you mentioned, to play the role. There are things in it that I think are interesting, and yes, the second half is better than the first half, but I found things about the first half to be intriguing, too. I like that it is a different kind of take on a story that we all, and anybody who's ever, you know, read the New Testament knows the story. And, you know, it's not the first movie that's ever been made, you know, about this story, but I think it's kind of an interesting take on it to attempt to make a mystery out of it. And my guess is that might have something that may have been Reynolds' idea to kind of change it and make it a little bit more of a different kind of a take on the film or on the story that we've seen a million times. But ultimately, it's really beautifully photographed. It's nicely made. You know, I mean, the guy's a terrific director, and I'm glad he's working. You know what I mean? I'm glad the guy's working, and it is not one of his better works at all. And I mean, this is, in fact, it might be my least favorite. No, it's not. Robin Hood is still my least favorite of his movies. But this one is probably my second least favorite. And people who don't know who Kevin Reynolds is a guy who deserves much more recognition than he gets. He's mostly known as a guy who has been in the past and been like Kevin Costner's best friend. and then
depending on the year,
and then not, and yeah. Then he is again, and then not. The thing about it is Kevin Reynolds is the director of a movie called Fandango, which came out in 1985 and is still one of my favorite movies of all time. And it was the breakout role for Kevin Costner. Now, the movie didn't make a lot of money when it came out. It was Spielberg discovered Kevin Reynolds, and they made the movie. And since Fandango, they've had a great relationship. They had a great relationship, Costner and Reynolds. Reynolds being the director, Kevin Costner. And then when Costner did Dances with Wolves, and this is fully admitted, Costner did not direct the best sequence in that movie. The best sequence in that movie is the buffalo hunt scene. Reynolds directed that sequence. And Costner, in fact, has admitted it, even though he did not thank him when he won the Academy Award for Best Director. And as a result, said, "Why don't you direct Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves?" And he directed it. Reynolds directed it, you know, with Costner obviously was the boss, you know, at that time because his star was huge. And the movie made a lot of money, so he got to work again. But in between that, in between Fandango and Robin Hood, he made one of my favorite war movies of all time called The Beast, which is a magnificent piece of work with Jason Patrick and an astounding performance of people who don't appreciate the genius of George DeZunza. You should watch The Beast because he's extraordinary in it. It's a really great film, a great, great film. No one saw it. Makes Robin Hood. Everybody sees that. Then he makes Rapa Nui, which I also think is a great movie. No one sees that. So he goes back to work with Kevin Costner again. And the result is Waterworld, which is a movie that I love. And he took the heat for it because it bombed and they blamed Kevin Reynolds. So he comes back and he does 187, which is a really personal movie, the best movie he's ever directed, I think. And then that doesn't do very well at all. So, you know, does the Count of Monte Cristo, which is a wonderful adaptation.
Yeah, it really is.
It's a really, but it's like 6 years in between, you know, doing, you know, that and 187. And then another like 5 years before he does Tristan and Isolde. And which is also a really good movie. But he comes back with Costner. And this story is amazing to me. I swear to God, the relationship between these two guys, I don't know. He comes back in 2012 with this miniseries that stars Costner and Bill Paxton. It's the Hatfields and McCoys. And it kicked ass. It was great. It was some of the best work that both Kevins have ever done. Ever. And then he disappears, he comes back, and he does this weird Christ movie. I don't understand this guy's career. Now, after this, my prediction is he and Kevin Costner will work together again. That's going to – because that just seems to be the pattern, right, guys? Like, he'll go off and do something on his own. It kind of bombs. This is clearly like, okay, you know, I'll co-write this. He kind of half-assed it. There's no question about it. It's better than – you know, it's better than a lot of movies that are out right now, Risen. It's better than a lot of movies that are out right now. But I'm just hoping that this gets him another gig. It did. Well, we'll talk about the box office later, but it did fine, right, Eric?
It did okay.
Yeah. I mean, but see, it didn't do as well as a lot of these other faith-based movies do. And because it's not really, it doesn't fall into the category of those other movies.
Not quite. And no. I mean, I'm sure that, I mean, the word of mouth might be decent on it, but it's, you know, the cause célèbre of these faith-based movies now are these, you know, these personal stories that, you know, deal with, you know, people seeing heaven and thinking they see in God and miraculous cures. I mean, I'm sure you saw the preview for Miracles from Heaven before you saw Risen.
Yeah, I don't even, you know.
Did you puke?
Yeah. That's Jennifer Garner, right?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah, I know.
Good God.
Yeah. If you've not seen some of this guy's work, he's a really great craftsman. He's a terrific American filmmaker who has made a lot of really great movies. Go look him up on IMDb, Kevin Reynolds, and check out his stuff. He's a tremendous filmmaker who has both been bitten in the ass and helped out quite a bit by his relationship with Kevin Costner. So it's a very interesting Hollywood story. I don't know. They should do an E! Behind the Scenes True Hollywood Story on the Kevins. I would watch. All right, guys, hang on, all right?
Okay,
all right. We got another movie to talk about, and then we'll get some Oscar predictions from the guys, and we'll talk box office as well. It is Monday morning, and it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hi. Monday Morning Movie Reviews continue. And we are talking with Eric Childress, who joins us every week, and Jim Leskowski, who's been filling in for Colin, who took a little time off. He'll be back with us in a couple of weeks. And we want to thank Jim, who's doing a great job reviewing the movies for us. And we got to get back here and talk about the new movies. Touched with Fire, Jim not recommending. Risen, Jim, Eric, and myself all were kind of in the middle on that one as well. And now we shall review The Witch. So, Jim, tell us about The Witch.
With pleasure.
Yeah.
The Witch is the debut film from Robert Eggers, and it opens with a close-up of Thomason, a teenage girl and the oldest child in the family, played by Anya Taylor-Joy. And it remains on her face as the voice of her father, William, played by Ralph Ineson, I believe, explains how they can no longer live in the Puritan community due to religious differences. The film then proceeds onward as the family makes their way into unexplored territory to set up a new home away from society in attempts to survive alone and thrive. There's mom and dad, a younger brother, as well as two twins. And, of course, if you've seen the trailer, there's also a new infant named Samuel, who one day just disappears. And this kicks off the plot in which a witch may or may not be messing with the family. After baby Samuel disappears into the woods, the family structure begins to break down, and their own sense of control, and it sort of slowly erodes. The parents cling desperately to their faith, and their answer seems to be to pray harder and to pray more and to confess and try to come to terms with their past, and more or less. They slowly grow more paranoid and suspicious of the teenage daughter in particular. Not to mention there's a peculiar black goat named Philip that the twins love to play with, who may or may not be up to no good himself. So, yeah, I absolutely loved this movie. I have zero issues with it. To me, it is dark folklore. It's a wonderful allegory that completely filled me with dread and tension pretty much right from the start, which I owe a lot to the score. That score was just something else. It sort of reminded me of how I felt watching Under the Skin from last year, just these really piercing orchestrated score that sort of reminded me of Kubrick. The family dynamics I found very compelling, and each time something strange happened, although the cause is kind of revealed early on, I still found myself on edge and unsure of how things would play out. The forces that are interfering with their stability are presented directly, but this is a folk tale, and we're sort of meant to directly experience their downfall firsthand, which made this a very human story, despite obviously the title and the supernatural element. I think the director sort of chose to weaponize vulnerability and something that people kind of take for granted sometimes, which is, you know, their own faith, that as long as they believe in something, then good things will happen. Well, sometimes consequence can still occur just as a result of frailty and pride and other outside forces. And I just, I found myself completely riveted by this movie. The ending of this movie, without giving anything away, just sort of says volumes about why certain people become what they become. It left me shaken. This is one of the best horror films to come along in quite some time. I cannot wait to see it again.
Okay. All right. And Eric?
Well, Jim had zero issues with the film. I have one issue with the film, one big issue that is enough to sink the film for me. He mentioned early on in his review about the appearance of a witch who may or may not be there. It's made very clear very early on in the film that there is a witch. It's revealed not too long later that there's possibly a second witch, or maybe a different manifestation of the first witch. And the acknowledgement of the supernatural element in the film so early on, to me, undercuts all of the themes that Jim has just been laying out really nicely. To me, this is a film about, should be about religious, in a way, sort of religious fundamentalism, sort of clinging to beliefs when that they're not going to help you anymore. And by giving evil a face in this movie rather than their belief structure being what causes their downfall, it really, to me, it's an element that I could not escape from, and it really bugged me throughout the entire movie. It lent an aura of predictability to the film that I was not expecting. I got to a point where I felt that everything in the film was completely being undercut by this one huge error in judgment on the part of Edgar's, and it led me to not being unnerved by the film, especially as the film went on. I felt exactly where this thing was going. I did not feel uneasy. I knew this was not an atypical horror film. I knew this was a very talky picture, so I was prepared for that. And by the end of the film, I felt that I had watched, you know, it was something closer to Blair Witch 2 more than Blair Witch. Clearly much better than Blair Witch 2. Let me preface that. Themes of the dread that Blair Witch Project gave don't hold, or the witch doesn't hold a candle to that, where Blair Witch 2 gave the characters in that movie a sort of a devil made you do it kind of thing and gave them an out for their irresponsible actions. And that's how I kind of feel what we've experienced here. I was not unnerved by the film. I was extraordinarily disappointed with this film. I'm curious to see it again, but I don't think I missed anything because I think Edgar's lays it all out on the table there 10 minutes in, and I could not escape it.
Okay. All right, we got a break. You guys, hang on, Eric and Jim. And we're reviewing The Witch, and it's a new horror film that just came out this past weekend. We got a break here for the news. When we come back, though, after the news, I'll give you my thoughts on The Witch, and we'll talk about the Academy Award nominations and our predictions, and we got the weekend box office as well. All right, it's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and it is Monday morning. We're in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews. We got Jim, we got Eric here, and we're going to find out what they are predicting as the winners for the Academy Awards, which are handed out this Sunday. All right, before the break, Jim and Eric gave us their reviews of The Witch. Jim really loved it. Eric did not. Eric, I'm with Jim on this one. I think it's great. Really, really, really great. What you're talking about, Eric, doesn't bother me at all. I think it adds depth to what's happening in the film. The reveal that there really is something supernatural happening here. There is a question. There's a lot of ambiguity in this movie, Eric. I don't think it's all cut and dry. I really don't, and I don't necessarily think that what we see is really what we see. A lot of times in this film. And
I've heard that argument, and I completely disagree with that.
Well,
I've seen, because there's no evidence in the movie to suggest that we're not seeing the truth.
Well,
kind of thing.
You know, I mean, I think it's not. Well, that's, to me, brings into question visually and storytelling wise, brings into question these people and their faith and what they really see, what they don't see, what they really believe, what they don't believe. I think that visually that adds an element to what the movie is really about. And I think it adds a real definite unnerving quality to the film. And also you question everything that these characters think and speak and say more. The fact that it opens with them being banished from a Puritan town, and it's never explained why. It's never explained why, which adds to me another layer of mystery to the movie. Like, what's going on with this family? Why were they banished? There's no clear reason why this family has been. It just opens up with the townspeople in a meeting saying, "Get out of here. That's it. You have to go beyond the woods and live out there." There's no explanation as to why, and I think by the end of the movie, you can kind of figure out why they were banished. I don't know. It seemed kind of obvious to me in that regard, but it adds a definite air of mystery to it. This is an incredibly well-made film, man. I mean, this is a beautifully made film, a refreshing example of the genre, considering how, you know, what's considered a great horror movie nowadays. And, you know, like let's just say, I mean, I really enjoyed The Conjuring. I think The Conjuring is a really good film. But this is miles more interesting and better made than that. And this is beyond, you know, what we expect from a horror genre. And, you know, last year we had It Follows, and last year we had Goodnight Mommy, the year before we had Babadook, and this belongs in that category. I mean, these are movies that are doing different things in the genre. You know, 2 weeks ago we had to sit through The Boy, which is a pretty decent example of the kind of crap that gets passed as horror movies. This movie felt like it was made in the 70s. It has a feel to it that's different. The audience that I saw it with had no idea what to make of it. They had no clue what to make of it. And let me just say this. The fact that this thing got a wide release is astounding. Eric, how did that happen? How did a movie like this, which should not be playing in malls, how did that happen?
I think A24 is just being more aggressive. I mean, not expect a film like this to go wide. This is the first time A24 has released a movie wide on opening weekend.
This is
ever, yeah.
Yeah.
2,000 screens for this movie, built pretty much solely on the strength of the critical buzz that has come since Sundance and Toronto and all the festivals that has played.
Well, I mean, this is, you want to talk about a movie that's going to split an audience down the middle, or maybe not even split an audience down the middle.
There are critics and there are moviegoers.
Yeah, and
moviegoers hate this thing.
Moviegoers do not like it. And when I walked, I will say this, though. I went with Mike View, my friend that I always go to the movies with now. I go with Mike, and then I go with my parents every weekend to the movies. And Mike doesn't like horror films. He hates them. He loved this movie. And, you know, when he was like, well, that was really interesting and dark and creepy and all of those things. But I think there's a lot more going on, Eric. I don't think it's as cut and dry. I think there's a sense of mystery, and I think there's a sense of what you see is not necessarily real because, you know, what you have faith in is not necessarily real. I don't know, man. I think there's still a lot of mystery to this movie and a lot of ambiguity. And then on the simplest of levels, it's an extraordinarily well-made movie. This is one of the best first-time directing jobs I've seen. The first thing that popped into my head as an auspicious directorial debut as this one, the first thing that popped into my head was Blood Simple. To me, it's that level of filmmaking and that level of an announcement of a filmmaker of this kind of caliber. It is really, really slow. Not much happens. The mood is extraordinary. Jim, I'm really glad that you mentioned the score. Mark Corvin wrote the score, and it is an unbelievable score. The photography is amazing. The sense of dread in this movie is tremendous. There are simple scenes in this movie that get under your skin where nothing really happens. The fact that none of us, we have to mention the performances in this movie. The acting in this movie is great. I don't know where the hell they got these kids. I don't know where this kid who played Caleb, I have no idea. I've looked him up. He's got, like, no credits. This kid's unbelievable. He's got a scene in the attic of the house where he may or may not be possessed. You don't know. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. The two leads in the movie, the adults in the movie, are both from Game of Thrones. They've been in Game of Thrones, and they're great. But this girl who plays Thomason, this Anya Taylor-Joy, she is incredible. It's an incredible performance, a great performance that goes through so many shifts and changes, and sometimes you think you know her and sometimes you think you don't. And by the end of the movie, in the final sequence of the film, it goes beyond. I mean, her performance and what her character is and what she might be and what she isn't, it goes beyond that. I don't even want to get into the creepy factor of this movie. There are scenes in this movie that I'm not going to forget for a long time. There are scenes in this movie that really freaked me out, like on a huge level. And some of them are really simple. Some of them are just, you know, an exchange of looks between two characters where I just went, ugh, and just had the, and I don't, you know, and don't even talk to me about how awesome Black Phillip is, because that, you know, and there's a sequence late in the movie that involves like something that happens to Black Phillip that just gave me the, my God, it gave me the creeps. And I think just on just the simplest of levels, but, you know, of a family dynamic, like the tensions between family unit at that time. I think it also captures the time period perfectly and really well. This movie blew me away. I really think it's an extraordinary piece of work and one of the best movies I've seen. It'll be on my list at the end of the year, and I have no question about it. And I just think, Eric, and I can totally understand your point. It didn't take me out of the movie at all, the reveal or how they handled the idea of the witch. Didn't take me out at all. It made me think differently while I watched it. And, you know, and I think the movie is about faith, whether it's good or whether it's bad. It's about evil. It's about good. We don't know about any of this stuff. And I think the movie, you know, accurately shows that both visually and it's in storytelling. I think it's a great film, man. I really do. And I can't wait to see it again. And yeah, and like I said, man, there's stuff in this movie where I was just like, "Oh my God!" You know, like it's like, "Geez." And Eric, it didn't freak nothing in the movie freaked you out at all?
No.
Wow.
No, I think the one scene that you kind of hinted at there involving Black Phillip.
Yeah.
Where I felt the movie actually should have ended before you get to the final scene. I think that scene works on its own, but it's the only scene that kind of made me go, ooh, I would have liked to have seen that in a better movie.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
See,
I was expecting to be unnerved, and I wasn't unnerved in the slightest.
Well, you know, okay, for me, by that point in the movie, well, look, Eric, your experience watching the movie was different than me and Jim, because by that point in the movie, I was already hook, line, and sinker.
Right.
I was already freaked out. I already was just like, you know, the scene that happens before that,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was like, you know, I was beside myself.
Yeah.
And then that long sort of like overnight take thing that they do, you know, with the girl.
Yes.
All of that built up to this Black Phillip scene where I was just like, okay, all right, enough. I can't. And then the scene that follows that, just like, to me, that was like the cherry on the cake. And I was just like, when the movie was over, I was just like, okay, I got to go. I got to go home, and I got to watch I got to watch the Lego movie. I have to.
I zipped up my coat, got in my car, and went home for a long winter's nap.
That's not at
all. I didn't care.
Wow. Okay. Jim, you and I in the same boat on this one, right?
Amen.
Yeah.
Preach it.
Well, I'm sorry. 100%
with you.
Guys, I thought it was great, man. I really do. But as you mentioned, Eric, this thing's going to tank next week.
Oh, God.
Oh my God. Is it going to
tank? I saw it with, I mean, I saw a 9:30 show on Thursday night, and there was like one row of like four people there at the theater.
Yeah.
And I mean, again, it's a very slow moving movie.
Yeah.
It's a very talky movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But you can just sense the mood of that row.
Yeah. And I admire A24 for doing that.
Yeah.
I really do, and that's a ballsy move, and I'm glad that they're going to get behind horror and then get behind stranger movies, but, oh, man, it's going to bite them in the ass, I'm telling you. So, all right.
Well, I was surprised when It Follows opened as wide as it did. It wasn't supposed to, but
It Follows.
They built that one up. The word of mouth was there, and they started small, and then that one at least had some good word of mouth. but look at it this way, Nick. I mean, if they would have platformed The Witch, and you put it in like two theaters in Chicago, and those people think they're going to see a horror movie, how do you think word of mouth is going to be then?
Well, but what they did with Goodnight Mommy, well, Goodnight Mommy is a foreign film as well, but what they did with Goodnight Mommy was brilliant the way that movie was released.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a lasting power. It made a good amount of money that you know, and it got great word of mouth from people who actively sought out something like that. I just think they made a mistake the way they released this film. I really do. But it's a great one nonetheless. But I'll tell you something, Eric. I know for a fact that I'm going to get a lot of pissed off listeners.
Oh, dude, the tweets Saturday night were unbelievable.
I know.
It was his own genre.
I know. All right, you guys, hang on. We got to take a break. We'll come back. And you guys ready for your Oscar predictions?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool. Hang on a second. Eric and Jim are with us. Don't say I didn't warn you about The Witch. It's not for everybody. It's not. Trust me. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Tribune Tower. Jim and Eric are with me. Jim Liskowski. You can check out NowPlayingNetwork.net for his podcast. Eric Childress is also with me. And we're about to give our predictions for the Academy Awards, which will be handed out on Sunday. I got to say, and I want to get your thoughts on this. This is going to be a pretty interesting Oscars, I think, because even a couple of the major categories, I don't really have a lock on. This is kind of unusual to be less than a week away from the Academy Awards and not really know what's going to win some major categories. Eric, would you agree with that?
Not as much as I would have about 3 weeks ago.
Really?
I think that most of the major categories seem to be decided. I think there's still a little bit of drama, whatnot, but I have a feeling that the drama is going to be subsided when, especially for a couple of the big categories, it's going to turn out exactly the way we hoped, or I should say feared.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jim, what about you? What are you thinking?
Yeah, I'm pretty much with Eric on that. I think, I definitely think a couple of categories are safe bets in terms of especially the major acting categories where I'm like, oh, yeah, there are locks right there for sure. But, yeah, I mean, Best Picture. I mean, that one I'm kind of iffy on. But overall, I think most of the major categories are easy to predict. Okay. Overall.
All right. Well, let's go through the nominees for the major categories. We're going to do the major acting categories: actor, actress, supporting actor, supporting actress. We'll do director. We'll do picture, and we'll do animated feature, which we'll start with. Let's start with animated feature film, and they are Anomalisa, Boy and the World, Inside Out, Shaun the Sheep Movie, and When Marnie Was There. Jim, what is your choice? What is your prediction?
Inside Out. Okay. Slam dunk.
Okay. And Eric?
Inside Out.
Yeah, we're all saying Inside Out. Yeah, and that's going to win, and it's a great movie, and yeah. So, all right, let's move on to supporting actress. Supporting actress, Jennifer Jason Leigh in The Hateful Eight, Rooney Mara for Carol, Rachel McAdams for Spotlight, Alicia Vikander for The Danish Girl, and Kate Winslet for Steve Jobs. Eric, what about you? What do you think?
I think Alicia Vikander.
Okay.
Going to win.
Okay. Jim?
Same here.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, good. All three of us in agreement on the two categories. And I don't necessarily think she does. I mean, you know, I would love to see Jennifer Jason Leigh get it.
Sure.
I think she's awesome, and she was great in The Hateful Eight. You know, I really thought that Rachel McAdams took kind of a turn for what we expect from Rachel McAdams in 2015 with her role in this and her role in True Detective 2. The second season, because she was so good in True Detective, and it was unlike anything she had ever done, and she was terrific in Spotlight as well. Is there a chance for anybody else, Eric, or is this a slam dunk?
No, I don't. I think of all the acting categories, this is the one that could provide a little bit of drama. I think it's so close, kind of all across the board. I think if there's possibly like an upset possibly coming, it wouldn't be a huge upset, but. For Kate Winslet for Steve Jobs, I think, could come up around the bend and take this just because she's so respected.
Right. And that's exactly what I think, too. I think the dark horse here is Kate Winslet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So actor in a supporting role, Christian Bale in The Big Short, Tom Hardy for The Revenant, Mark Ruffalo for Spotlight, Mark Rylance for Bridge of Spies, and Sylvester Stallone for Creed. Jim, we'll start with you.
I'm gonna go on a limb here and say Mark Rylance for Bridge of Spies. As much as I want Stallone to win, I don't know if it's gonna happen for sure.
Mm. Okay, Eric.
It's gonna happen. Sylvester Stallone is winning.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. I gotta say that I'm gonna say Stallone's gonna win, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if Mark Rylance won. I don't think it's as big a slam dunk, Eric, as you think it is. I mean, I think he's going to get it. But,
yeah.
And it would be, you know, I mean, if the Academy Awards are looking for a moment, you know,
right,
for the show, that's it.
Well, here's the thing with Stallone. There's a couple things to consider here. One, Stallone's going to go up there, assuming supporting actor is the first award of the night.
Yeah.
Stallone's going to get up there. It's going to be a great, huge standing ovation moment for the Oscars. And he's going to go up there and he's going to thank Michael B. Jordan and Ryan Coogler, which the Oscars could use a little of this year.
Yeah.
Okay, so they have that. And then supporting actor at the SAG Awards, you remember who that went to?
Yeah, it went to Stringer Bell.
Right.
Yeah.
Went to Idris Elba, who is not nominated.
Right.
So, like, Stallone wasn't nominated for the SAG, and Idris Elba's not nominated for the Oscar. They're going to give it to Stallone.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, what are you going to say, Jim?
No, that's okay. I was just going to say that supporting categories seem to be the one where the Oscars like to be a little daring sometimes. So that's kind of why I went on a limb there.
All right. All right. For actress, it's Cate Blanchett for Carol, Brie Larson for Room, Jennifer Lawrence for Joy, Charlotte Rampling for 45 Years, Saoirse Ronan for Brooklyn. I'll go first on this one. Brie Larson, Eric.
Brie Larson.
And?
Jim? Brie Larson.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a slam dunk. Actor, do we even really need to?
No.
I mean, it's going to DiCaprio.
DiCaprio.
Yeah, it's going to go to DiCaprio. Yep. Okay, director. This is one of the two that I'm not sure of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you got George Miller for Mad Max. You got Adam McKay for The Big Short. You got Lenny Abramson for Room. Alejandro Iñárritu for The Revenant, and Tom McCarthy for Spotlight. All right, Eric, ultimately, who are you going with?
I'm going with Iñárritu. to pull the back-to-back.
Okay. And
Yeah, I am too. As much as it pains me to say it, I'm also pulling for – well, obviously I'm pulling for George Miller, but in your odds, I think he's going to get it.
Well, I think they're going to give it to Inarritu as well. But, you know, if they don't want to give it to him, what is the chance that George Miller might sneak in there and get it?
Here's the thing to look at. This is what I've been saying for about a month now. Be very wary what wins best editing next Sunday night.
All right.
Best editing could be the ultimate foreshadowing of what wins best picture.
Okay.
Okay. Now it's very possible Mad Max could win that award, and I think it is going to win that award. Mm-hmm. But if you see Big Short or Spotlight win that award, then that might be your best picture winner.
Yeah, that's interesting. Some of those technical awards are going to be telling this year. There's no question about it. But Mad Max has got to win Best Editing, for God's sake.
I know. I don't even want to hear it. Loses.
All right, Best Picture, we got to do this because we got to wrap it up. And then, Eric, you and I are going to talk about box office. The Big Short, Bridge of Spies, Brooklyn, Mad Max, Fury Road, The Martian, The Revenant, Room, Spotlight. Jim.
Oh, man, this is another tough one. But I'm going to say The Revenant.
Okay. Eric?
I'm going with The Revenant.
Okay, I'm going with Spotlight. I think Spotlight is going to win Best Picture. I really do. So
I'd be fine with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would be too. I'd be
happy. I would, you know, to be honest with you, I'd be fine with any of them winning.
It's true. I mean, seriously.
Because I like all of the movies.
I do too. Yeah. I do too. And this is the year when critics are going to turn against The Revenant, even though they all like it.
Yeah, I'm not going to turn against it.
You know, nothing turns the critics against a movie quicker than the Oscars.
Yeah, it's true. I'm still going to love it. I don't give a damn if it wins an Oscar or not. All right, Jim, thank you, buddy. And
All right, sounds good.
All right, now I'm off next Monday morning. We may end up doing this on Tuesday morning. Are you guys available for that? Eric, you might not be. Jim, you are?
I'll be around.
All right, Jim, I think next Monday morning or Tuesday morning when we do this, it might be your last show with us, and I want to we'll thank you because I think Colin will be coming back the following week.
Okay. All right, Jim. Sounds like a plan to me, man.
All right, Jim. Thanks, buddy.
Okay. Talk to you next week.
Okay. There you go. There's Jim. Eric, hang on. All right. When we come back, we'll take a break, and we will talk about the box office right here on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We reviewed all the new movies and we made our Oscar predictions. The Academy Awards will be handed out on Sunday night. And we're back and we'll talk more Oscar stuff. We got some Oscar topics that we're going to hit upon. We've got a very, very unfortunate Blackhawks Express to play back from yesterday's embarrassing game. On a national spotlight too, in the national spotlight yesterday, really terrible Hawks game, but we'll get that. And my dad will cheer us all up with a joke cause it's Monday morning. So it's a jokey time. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text 312-981-7200. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. Always check out our podcasts. They are available. The podcasts are available in the morning after the show, and you can go to WGNradio.com to check those out and subscribe to them. They're free at iTunes. Go to iTunes, subscribe to the Nick DiGilio Show podcast. Every second of the show is podcast. If you miss any of it, you can listen to it at your leisure, bro. It's free, and you subscribe. It'll show up on your device, and you can listen to it anytime you want at your leisure, bro. So get our podcast at WGNradio.com and our Facebook page. We want to hit 12,000 fans, so like us. It's interactive. It's constantly updated. It's a lot of fun to be on the Facebook page while the show is happening. And it's Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay. Box office. Eric Childress talks about the box office every week. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go through the list and talk a little bit about the deal here. Number one, second week in a row, Deadpool with $55 million. Oh, man.
Yeah.
$235 million total. This thing is a smash. Did anyone see these kind of numbers?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
And anyone who tells you that is a liar because, I mean, there's just no way anyone could have predicted, you know, especially with the R rating, you know, that's getting a lot of play these days. But you know, no one could have predicted that it was going to do this well. You know, it was guaranteed. Like, $55 million is what I expected to do on its opening weekend.
Right.
You know,
right.
So now that's $235 million. It's $300 million is just about guaranteed. It's going to hit that sometime next week. And, you know, $350 million for American Sniper and $370 million for Passion of the Christ. Those numbers are in play right now.
Yeah. Unbelievable. It really is. It's actually kind of stunning that no one really expected this. Now, you know, everybody's going, yeah, Deadpool, man, you know, R-rated comic book movie. It's not the first R-rated comic book movie. It seems to people have forgotten that there have been a lot of R-rated comic book movies. But a lot of the people who are screaming about how great Deadpool is have conveniently forgot about a ton of R-rated comic book movies.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, I've seen all the memes this week, and yeah, they're cute and funny and whatnot. But the fact remains that, you know, even the top R-rated comic book movies don't even come close to these numbers. And I think that's the distinction here. I mean, it's like, you know, like Watchmen and Constantine and The Crow and whatnot. These are movies that Watchmen did just a little over $100 million.
Yeah.
Constantine did 75 total. The Crow did over 50.
Yeah.
So, like, Deadpool's kicking their ass.
Yeah, and I mean, even Blade didn't do nearly as well as Deadpool. But but it's not the first time somebody's made an R-rated comic book movie.
No, just one that's been this successful.
Right. Okay. That's crazy. Number two, Kung Fu Panda 3 with 12.5 million, 117 million total. And were you surprised that Kung Fu Panda was in at number two?
Not really, because I wasn't expecting much out of the three new releases this week. So, I, you know, with no other family movies out there, I mean, that's all there is to see.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then Risen comes in at number three with $11.8 million. Is that the movie that you expected to be the top of the new films?
Yeah,
okay.
It was.
Mm-hmm.
There was some talk that The Witch might have actually ended up with a higher weekend, but after the Thursday showing, I'm like, no.
Yeah.
It might have a solid – I think it actually beat Risen on Thursday night. A little bit, but by the end of the weekend, the Risen, you know, not that it's the most impressive victory in the world.
No, I know.
But it did 11.8 million.
Oh, I know. I just am stunned that The Witch is on 2,500 screens. That's the first thing. Like, I saw this movie in a building that houses a Buffalo Wild Wings, and I was like, I don't know how that happened.
Because I think it kind of shows you where marketing movies are these days, is that you don't necessarily need a star, you know, you don't need, you know, giant stars. You know, if you just say horror and you call the movie The Witch, you know, you could get an audience. Oh, let's go see The Witch. It's supposed to be, I hear good buzz. It's supposed to be really good.
Right.
And here's the thing, is that this movie is completely getting its audience really based on the word of mouth by critics.
Right.
You know, there was no C-minus cinema score going into this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't show up till Saturday.
Right.
So all the people had was an 88% score at Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay. I don't know. I just find it all amusing. I really do. I just, because I'm just picturing, you know, some teenagers, you know, figuring out, you know, after a day at the mall, hey, let's go see the new scary movie. You know what I mean? Like
right.
a couple of 17-year-olds go, yeah, this will be our group of like 17 and 18-year-old girls and guys. Yay, yay. 10 minutes into the movie. What the hell is this?
Yeah. No, I'm completely with you there.
We got to go. Let's go to Cinnabon now. All right, number five, How to Be Single with 8.2 million. Not a hit.
No, not really.
And then, man, this is really bad. Race, $7.2 million.
Yeah.
Did you expect that low a number?
Yeah, I did, actually.
Really?
I mean,
oh.
Focus Features is not really good at opening movies. I mean, it's an indie division, granted, and they do a lot of wide releases, but they just their marketing division has never really been very good about getting the word out, and the mediocre reviews certainly didn't help.
Yeah.
So I was certainly expecting under 10 million. So seven, eight seemed about right for me.
Okay. Boy, number seven, Zoolander 2. Wow.
Yeah.
5.5 million, 2 weeks, 23.7 million. That's not good.
Proof that nobody was calling for this movie.
Yeah. Nobody was.
Nope.
Number eight, Star Wars. Now, here's the question.
Yeah.
When is Star Wars going to drop out of the top 10? Is that going to happen anytime soon?
Well, interesting question. This could be the last week in the top 10. I think it all depends on pretty much how Zoolander 2 does next weekend.
Okay.
Because there are three new movies opening next week. You have Eddie the Eagle, you have Triple Nine, and you have the Gods of Egypt thing. Now, even if those three movies tank, they're probably not going to tank to the tune of, you know, less than $3.8 million, what Star Wars made this weekend. So okay. It's very possible that just those three movies push Star Wars back to number 11, unless Zoolander 2 really tanks, which I think it might, and you might see Star Wars one more week.
One more week in the top 10, which would make it in the top 10 since for over 2 months.
18th. Almost 3 months. It'll be the, this is the 10th week.
Yeah.
10th straight week. Here's an interesting thing is that, you know, Avatar spent 14 weeks in the top 10 before it dropped out.
Yeah.
Titanic spent 26 weeks.
Oh my God.
In the top 10, and 15 of those were at number one.
That's unbelievable.
So now you have The Force Awakens, which is the biggest movie of all time in the U.S., and it's going to spend as long in the top 10 as The Phantom Menace did in 1999.
Wow. Wow. All right.
That's how the movie, how the box office has changed.
Absolutely, man. Number nine is The Revenant, $3.8 million. If it wins Best Picture, do we see it? Is it good? Well, I mean, it's still going to be pretty strong because of the Academy Awards this week. People will go and see it.
Yeah, it'll still do well this week. Some people still catch up with it. If it wins Best Picture, which we think it's, some of us think it's going to, it'll probably get a bit of a bump. Maybe Fox might put it back into a few more theaters to capitalize on that for a week or two. But $165 million, that's the third highest grossing film of DiCaprio's career.
Is that right?
Yep.
Wow. Okay.
Behind only Titanic and Inception.
Those are the two that made more money.
Yep.
Holy cow.
It just passed Catch Me If You Can and Django Unchained this week.
Wow. Okay. All right. Where's Wolf of Wall Street fall on that list?
I think that did like $135 million, something like that.
All right.
Yeah.
Number 10, Hail Caesar, $2.6 million, bringing its total up to $26 million. Not a hit.
No.
Yeah.
But it's a Coen Brothers movie, and that's to be expected, I guess.
All right.
For a wide release.
And now let me ask you this. This the movies that are opening next week, is this this Gods of Egypt thing? I don't even know what to say. I don't even know what I'm going to, you know, I don't know what I'm going with my parents to see it.
Okay.
Because I was like, you know, my dad's like, what are we going to see this week? You know, because I didn't see a new movie with them this weekend because I had my screening of Scarface.
Right.
And so they came out for that because, my mom likes swearing and my dad likes cocaine.
Okay. So, well, then why aren't you taking them to see Triple Nine?
Yeah, that's good choice. I was like, yeah, maybe it's like a Sinbad movie.
Okay.
You know, it'd be like, we'll go see. Remember when I was a kid and you used to take me to those Sinbad movies?
Yeah.
That's what it's going to be. And who Alex Proyas directed
this? Alex Proyas.
What the hell happened to that? I was never on board. I have to say, I was never on board with the Alex Proyas.
Well, I mean, the Crow was a thing. Crow, I mean, which had all kinds of press for, you know, for really tragic reasons, obviously.
Right.
And did okay. And then, obviously, Roger Ebert really championed Dark City.
Right.
Which really kept him. But you really, other than those two movies... Ebert also really championed Knowing, the Nicolas Cage
film. I know he did. That
movie actually did pretty well at the box office. But you know how much this Gods of Egypt movie costs?
I would imagine a lot.
$140 million.
Oh, my God.
But apparently the studio apparently is only like on the hook for like $10 million of it because Australia gave them a bunch of tax credits and stuff.
Oh, okay.
So, like, basically, this movie is on the Australian government or something.
Wow.
they flipped the bill for this thing. And this thing, I think this thing is going to tank huge.
Oh, I think so, too.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what? Come on, really, seriously. Why?
No, seriously.
I look at it and I'm like, are we just building up to the London Bridge is falling down movie thing?
We had back-to-back weeks with Gerard Butler vehicles.
What is that about, man?
I don't know, man.
Oh, all right.
I mean, they've moved around. The London Has Fallen release date has moved around a couple times.
Yeah.
So that just happens to work out that way.
It's ridiculous.
I think Gods of Egypt got moved, too, at some point.
It's ridiculous, man.
Yeah.
It's completely ridiculous. Okay, all right. Well, we got stuff we got to review next week. Deadpool number one next week again, you think, Eric?
Oh, easily.
Okay.
Easily.
All right. All right, Eric, thanks, man. We got movies to review next week, and we won't be back on Monday morning because I'm taking the morning off after the Oscars.
Okay. I'll try to be there on Tuesday. I have to see how the schedule lays out.
Yeah, Tuesday morning, if you can do it, that'd be great, and we'll talk about the Oscars, and we'll review the other movies that are coming out, okay?
Okay.
All right, Eric, thanks, buddy.
Sure thing.
There you go. Eric Childress and Jim Liskowski. Again, I'm off next Monday morning. I'm taking the morning off after the Oscars, but I'll be back Tuesday morning, and we'll get Eric and Jim in here to talk about the Oscars and to review the new films.